This is CliffCentral.com.
You know, sometimes people come into the studio and you don't really know them because you've met once or twice, but you don't know them, but you've seen them so much.
Right.
That you think, you feel like, I know this person.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure people walk up to you all the time, Desmond Dube.
Yeah.
Everywhere, all over this country. And I mean, like, you are one of those people with appeal across the board.
Right.
Everybody goes, I know you.
Yeah.
And you're like, actually, no, you don't know me, but thanks.
Yeah.
It's a compliment, though.
Yeah. I guess you kind of get used to it, you know. I mean, one of my worst questions ever is when people go, especially in Cape Town, I don't know why it happens in Cape Town so much, where people go, where do I know you from?
Yeah.
And I go,
that's your job to figure that out.
Yeah, there's like 4,000 choices here. It could be a church. Do you go to church? You know, I do that just to string them along. Yeah, yeah. do you go to church? Do you play soccer? No. Karate club, you know, and you can see the guy has not done any sport in his life. You know, and you go, karate club? No. Mm-mm. You know, so you spend the last 5 minutes just kind of trying to guess. And then I eventually go, look, man, I don't think that's a good question. Eh?
It's such a bad way to start with someone because I think they know. I think they know, but maybe they want you to tell them.
Yeah.
Which is also, like, that's a bad place. If you want to connect with somebody, don't start like that. Just say, hey,
sure.
I'm sure I recognize you. I'm whatever.
Absolutely.
Then you're going to go, I'm Desmond.
Absolutely.
It's just because a lot of people are very unused to being tidy. They're messy.
Yeah.
They're messy. Their lives are messy. Their relationships are messy. Yeah. They don't know how to deal with people. They don't have they've got rough edges.
Right.
They're not refined. And I'm not saying everybody has to be like textbook good manners.
Sure.
But there's a way to deal with people that gets you ahead.
Yeah.
And there's a way to deal with people that makes you look like you're a Philistine.
Sure.
And you want to be the former, not the latter.
Sure. No, I get it. I get it. I hear you. It's often people don't know what to say.
Yeah, that's also it. They're uncomfortable.
They become uncomfortable. They feel like saying something, but they don't know what it is. You know.
They want to connect, but they don't know how.
Yeah. One of my favorite is, because I wear caps all the time, you know, is when you find people going, take off your cap.
No, you don't do that.
Yeah. Take off your cap, man.
That mustn't be the first thing you say to someone.
You kind of go, I know that you want to talk to me because you recognize me.
But give me an instruction.
But don't start with something like that.
You do you know? Ever get people
Do you know that I'm a father to kids? You know what I mean? Like, do you know how awkward it would be if my kids were with me and someone orders me to take off my cap? You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just weird. It's coarse.
Yeah,
Do you ever get people who say to you after you've taken the 20th picture with them, smile?
Yeah. Well, look, I have a permanent smile.
Yeah, you smile, but then they want you to do something else.
Yeah. No. But you know, the people who take pictures and then they go, no, all these pictures are ugly. Can you come back? You know, no, I can't come back. I was actually on my way to work right now.
Yeah, I didn't come here to meet you.
Yeah.
But you're a very friendly dude. And I mean, I have met you a couple of times, but you are an institution in South African television. I mean that in the most complimentary way. I don't mean it like, you know, where you're part of the furniture. I mean, you're one of those people who you seem always to be having a good time. You love what you do.
Yes.
Whether it's serious acting, presenting a TV show, doing ads, whether you're out in the community, whether you're making theater, which we know you do as well.
Right.
You love what you're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm glad you said that. You know, my motto is, if you don't love it, don't do it. Period. If you feel uncomfortable doing something, then don't do it.
Have you never done a job you didn't like doing?
I have. I mean, because I had to, you know. And I'm glad. I mean, it's a blessing to be in a position to be able to say, I think I'm going to skip this one. Look, I've made mistakes in the industry as well.
Yeah.
Where there's been projects that I kind of, you know, I was asked to be a part of, and I go through the project itself and it just does not talk to me. And then I go, nah,
Give me an example, because this is what people never do. They never get into an interview situation and admit the shitty stuff up front. They always go, no, oh, yes, that was terrific. And yes, I was in that Oscar-nominated movie. And yes, I've been in these very successful productions. And yes, I've been employed in an industry for 15, 20 years where most people last one.
Yeah.
But they don't talk about the shitty stuff.
Yeah. You know, a few years ago, I'll give you a perfect example. A few years ago, Ice Cube did a film called The Spear. Which ended up with Eric Mieni being, you know, playing the role that they had asked me to play. And I think he was perfect because he looked slightly older than I was at the time, spoke like an educated guy for the role. But when I read the initial script, I was just like, no.
So they wanted you for it.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember saying to my agent, is it okay to say no? Because I battled with that script for like I said, it could have been an education thing where I felt like maybe I'm not understanding the plot of the script, you know.
Maybe it was just a stretch and because you're the kind of guy who would like the challenge.
Sure.
But it wasn't gelling.
It wasn't gelling. So I said to my agent, no, I think, this one I'm going to skip.
Is it hard to say no, especially if there's money and it's a movie that you really... Because, Ice Cube.
Yeah.
For God's sake.
Yeah.
That, no one's going to say no to that without thinking very hard about it.
Without thinking very hard about it.
Is it difficult to say no?
And I just got to give you an idea of the position that I was in at the time, you know. I mean, I was still a young man living in Hillbrow. And so I needed the money. But I was also at a stage where I was hanging out with a seasoned people in the industry, Marius Veyers, people who were always saying, look, the sustainability of an actor or a performer is the choices you make earlier in your life. You know, you can make a choice for the wrong reasons. Sometimes those wrong reasons might be the dollar.
What you're saying is so right.
And
whether you learned that or whether you are living it, because I think you are living that.
Right.
You've made some interesting choices. You were very selective at the beginning. And later on in your career, you can afford to be less selective. I mean, if you look at Robert De Niro.
Right.
When he started off, he was doing these Oscar-winning roles, these incredible portrayals, Taxi Driver, these kinds of... Now, he's in Zac Efron movies. And it doesn't matter so much because it's Bob De Niro. You're not going to go, oh, he's crap now.
Absolutely.
Because you know who he is. Yeah. He's quantified. He's got his value.
Yeah.
I think it's the same for you. Yeah. I mean, you've got such a lot of talent. You've done so many different things.
No, thank you, man. Thank
and you're
you.
Good at all of them.
Yeah.
There's nothing that you're shitty at.
No, thank you.
But you could afford to put yourself into, for example, ads.
Right.
Which a lot of actors, if they go into that in their 20s as their first job, that's all they're ever going to do.
Right.
And they won't do it for big brands either.
Right.
You can afford to do that, right?
I can afford to do that. Look, I think, like I said, you know, I was fortunate and blessed enough in the industry earlier to sort of being around the seasoned actors.
So who else is there? Marius Veyers. I mean, this guy is unparalleled in South African film.
Right.
He's a real titan.
Frank Opperman, you know, these are my friends. John Carney, Winston and Jonah, you know. You think about Bra Winston, for example, I mean, this man... Bra Winston right now, as we speak, lives in PE, works in New York, Washington, LA.
What a stupid you know what thing I mean? To live in PE, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, really.
No, but this is exactly it, you know, and I make this example all the time. I go, here's a man who is what an actor. Doesn't care about living in Johannesburg where all the things are happening because he made a choice or he made choices earlier in his life. So he gets a call from LA to say, listen, there's a film we're doing, and by the way, it's always exotic for the Americans. You know, I say this to the young people who are so eager to go from AFDA to go to America. And I go, you know how exotic it is for them to, I have an agent in England at the moment who says, you know how easy it is to sell you as an actor from Africa who lives in Africa.
They love it, right?
Yeah.
It's got an authenticity to it. It's
like I said, exoticness about, right. You know, oh, by the way, I've got this guy coming from South Africa. You guys are going to see him in about a week. He'll be here, you know. rather than I've got this African actor who has been living in New York for 5 years.
Right. No one cares.
No one cares. Then the producers go, well...
And when they describe that he's in PE,
yeah,
people are like, Jesus, where is that?
Where is that? Yeah, exactly. You know, so this is exactly it. People like Winston and Chona, who have done great work, selective films, but lives in PE. You know, so you Peter Derek Ace, same thing.
These are your friends. I mean, you hang with these people? Yeah.
Well, I used to. I mean, obviously, you know, life just sort of happens. And in Joburg these days, you're lucky if you saw somebody once a year. Yeah. You know, but these are the people that I've learned from. You know, I kind of took cues from them that, okay, so this is how you do it. I mean, a guy like the late Prayuma Segela, you know, God bless his soul, but same thing, you know, Prayu would do like what, 5 gigs maybe in 5 months,
you know. But he'd be appreciated and paid.
Absolutely.
And entrusted with.
Yeah, and then retreat back to his farm.
Correct.
You know, and just go and, you know, and you see him at the theater every night, kind of going, yeah, what's on? I want to come and see another show. I'm bored, Dube, you know? You know?
He spent a lot of time with young people.
Yes.
As a mentor.
Yes.
And I think that's what a lot of people who didn't maybe spend time with him, who only knew him from the press, from his shows and from his gigs, maybe they didn't know. He spent a lot of time with young talent.
Yeah. But, I mean, his music also, you could tell, you know, for him to go and collaborate with Black Coffee and, you know, and Thandi Somaswai and so on. You can tell. This is a man who is ready to just give, you know. And if you think about it, Brayu started in this industry when he was 18, 19. Got his first flugelhorn.
That's right.
You know.
I mean, there's that picture of him. Yeah. There's that picture of him from Sophia Town, you know. He was there.
He was doing King Kong, which is a show I'm doing now.
Now, isn't this interesting? Like circles within circles.
Yeah.
So you're doing King Kong now.
Right.
How's that going, first of all?
It's going fantastic, you know.
You enjoy doing the stage stuff?
I love doing the stage stuff. I mean, for the past 5 years, I've been aggressively doing stage stuff. James Noble from the Market Theatre was saying, dude, can you just stop? Because, you know, every year when we look at all the awards, you're always nominated for something. Meaning, you know, you are actually living in the theater now. You know.
So what's this role, Pop?
Pop is he's the storyteller. He's the guy who tells. He was a friend of Ezekiel Dlamini, who Pop is a barber, and he comes across these little lighties who are, you know, who think they are strong, you know, they can fight, they're violent young men, and there are no consequences. And he decides to tell them the story of Ezekiel Dlamini, which is a true story, you know. And somebody asked me the other day what King Kong's is about. And I said, well, it's a story of caution. You know, we've seen the Oscar Pistoriuses, we've seen the O.J. Simpsons, and in South Africa here, we've seen young guys like Jup Jup, you know, where fame just runs to your head and gives you a false sense of power that you forget the responsibilities of, you know, of being famous. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a tough world. You know, somebody was once asked me, you know, what does it feel like being famous? And I said, it's great at times, but it's got its downfalls. You become a target before you even open your mouth at times. You know what I mean?
If people have good intentions with you,
it's
great.
It's awesome.
If they have bad intentions with you,
you're
going to have a tough time because you can't hide.
Yeah.
Like you can hide in anonymity.
Sure.
You can't hide in fame.
Yeah.
So I'm amazed by another thing about you, and this is something that you probably just take for granted because it is your life. But you've been married to the same woman for 15 years.
Yeah.
And so few people in this.
I like that. Yeah.
This
married to the same woman.
Yes.
Yeah.
In this business, that doesn't happen.
Right.
That's a rare and special thing. I cannot think. The only person I've spoken to in the last while who's been married to the same woman for even longer, but in a different profession, in a different business, is Bantu Holomisa.
Right.
And I was talking to him, and he said for him, it's he's just in love with his wife even now.
Yeah.
And he said that the two of them have the greatest relationship. Yeah. There's respect.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you get it right? 15 years in entertainment, man.
I think, first of all, I married right. You know, I married a great girl. She, my wife is an amazing chick.
Yeah.
Because I'm a crazy guy, you know. I mean, you should know, in this industry, you need a tinge of that craziness to get you over the bridge, you know, or bridges, rather.
It's a little personality aberration. There's going to be some area where you're not at all perfect, where it's coarse and it sometimes bubbles over.
Right.
That's what talented people are.
Now, I've got pockets of that imperfection, you know, of those imperfections, rather. But that's what makes me. But then I've got this chick who's just so level-headed, who sometimes just laughs off certain things and just goes, you know.
She's not an entertainer.
No, she's not.
That's also important. You know, if she was.
She dips in and out of it. I mean, my wife has gone into publishing recently, so she deals a lot with artists. And,
but that's very different to what you do.
That's very different. But that's it. And I think I'm like the General Bantu Olomisa. I'm in love with this woman who is absolutely perfect in every aspect of, you know, she ticks all the boxes. And I think that's it. It just makes it a lot easier when you're married to someone who understands who you are, who doesn't judge you for whatever reason, and who straightens you out without scolding. You know what I mean? My wife has got this thing where she can ask me a question that deals with an entire, you know, wrong department of my life. You know what I mean? Just one question. And I go, why do you ask me that question in that way? Why, man? Why? And then it bothers me for like a month, you know, that she asked me that question. But that's exactly it. That's the person you want to be with, instead of someone who, you know, will lay some kind of a judgment and say, you're selfish, you're like this, you're like this.
Yeah.
She has a way of just laying a question on the table.
But you talk about these wrong departments in your life. I mean, we all make mistakes and none of us is perfect. But the thing about you that's impressive is that you seem to me to be very together. Like, you could easily have gone off the rails with success, and because it's such an unstable industry.
Sure.
You don't know.
Sure.
You could have a film project for 6 months and make really good money, and then for 6 months you're nothing.
Absolutely.
That's how it works in entertainment, even if you've got a reputation like yours, because sometimes the projects just don't roll around.
Yeah.
And particularly when you have a media industry that's in such disarray, where, you know, the public broadcaster isn't commissioning new shows.
Yeah.
The private production companies, the margins are very tight. Local and international film budgets are being squeezed. People don't necessarily want to film in Joburg. They want to film in Cape Town. You have to change your life around. It's a very unstable business, is what I'm saying.
Sure, and it also swings from side to side depending on what's in.
Yeah.
You know, for example, one young actor was saying to me, hey, you know, I've got to get my Twitter live, you know, in order, you know. And I was like, why? Why? Why do you want that? Why do you want to bring, you're a good-looking, talented guy. Why do you want to bring people to come and sit in the front seats of your life? Because for me, that's how I look at social media. You know, that's why you'll see most of my accounts are private. You know, I want to see who you are. Why do you want to follow me? For what? What is it that you
want? And also, you've made a living out of selling out that front row.
Right.
So it's for you, it's a transaction.
Right.
You've always understood you're putting in a value.
Man.
They must put some value in,
you're
too.
You're smart. That's why you're...
Well, no, you see, I don't have private accounts. I'm not as smart as you, because that's the way to do it, actually.
But I've, you know, my view on the social media thing has always been people, not all the people are there to really love you.
Mm-hmm.
They don't come to follow you.
No.
They want the front seat of your life, so that they are the first to know when to attack. I'll give you a perfect example. I don't know if you what's Tineo Ranaga's show?
The Ranaga's. Yeah, it's her family show.
Tineo's Diary, yeah.
She's had her dad and her mom and everything.
Sure,
in there.
I remember, and I think this is when it broke my heart, when this girl had a baby and she posted a baby on Twitter, you know, a picture of a baby. And suddenly what we name Black Twitter, people just became so ugly. You know, the devil just came out of this.
What did they say? The child was ugly.
They were saying the child is ugly.
Jesus.
And I remember, you know, kind of following her for a little while, and people, you know, and obviously she went through a depression at that time. And I thought, this is exactly it. This is what I've been saying. Like, more people that are following you, you know, just want the front seat
We've got, and this links to what I was going to ask you anyway, so I'll just tie it all together. But we've got a lot of hurt, broken people in South Africa.
Absolutely.
Right? And when you talk about things like Black Twitter, I watch during shows like Date My Family or Our Perfect Wedding or whatever, I just see malice.
Mm.
I see a lot of hurt, angry, unhappy people who then take that anger and unhappiness and hurt and they project it at other people because they think it'll make them feel better.
Yeah.
But it actually just doesn't help anyone.
Yeah. But that's exactly what it is. But how do you avoid? Also disguised under funny. You see, there's a reason why Trevor Noah is Trevor Noah, Eugene and
Causa,
you know, there's a reason why these guys are called funny. Is because they were intelligent enough to be able to make people laugh without necessarily hurting an entire nation.
Right.
So what social media has done is that it's opened up this broadcast platform for everybody to think they're funny.
Yeah.
And when they actually become hurtful.
And so many of them are not even they're not even engaging properly. They just want to get out there and lash out. They want to be heard.
Yeah.
But you're not like that at all. You're very stable. I mean, what kind of a childhood? You're very stable. I mean, you've held down an incredible career through some pretty tough times.
Right.
And you know your stuff. You know the right people.
Right.
You're dependable.
Right.
People are happy to sign you up for any project because they know you'll deliver.
Right.
You know, you've got the stability in your personal life. Now, I want to know what kind of childhood you had because that had to be where it started.
Probably. But, you know, I mean, I'm glad you used the word dependable because I also learned that quite early in my life that talent alone, you know, I know a lot of talented guys who are not working. It doesn't matter in what field they're talented in, you know, because if it's just talent on its own, and you don't have the discipline to be on time. You don't have, because time is money, you know, and being reliable is probably more important than the talent you have. If you're not going to pitch up, producers will pay close to $300,000-$400,000 for that day that you missed.
Yeah.
You know, and I've heard of horrific stories of artists who, you know, the guy calls and he says, can we not shoot these scenes today, man? I'm in Pretoria now, you know. Slept in Pretoria because my sister's party. So let's not shoot. Can we shoot these, you know, and the crew is already there. And I've experienced it as a producer. So, and then that's when you kind of go, whoa, you know, is it an understanding? Is it a, but anyway, to answer your question, I grew up as a lighty in multiple families, and also maybe even across the country. You know, I was listening to your interview with another guest, which is why I speak different languages. You know,
now you speak how many?
I speak 9 languages. You know, so my mother used to work for I don't know if you remember a company called Dairy Bell.
Yeah, they were the milk and dairy producers,
You know, and...
had that cow on their logo.
Yeah. That orange cow.
Yeah.
I used to hate that cow as a lady. Yeah. So she would be sent to different regions. And we would have to follow, you know.
So wherever she went, we'd
have to go to school there, you know. And there were times where they would send her in the middle of the year, they would send her to a different region. And then whoever she made friends with in that area where we are, like in Bagville. I remember in Bagville I stayed.
Where is that?
Bagville is in KwaZulu-Natal, just on the other side of Qwaqwa.
Okay.
Yeah. Before Pietermaritzburg, you know, it's just hidden in the hills.
In the Drakensberg.
In the Drakensberg, yeah. Okay. And, you know, we ended up staying with friends of hers, you know. And I think that, as a kid, will humble you quite quickly when you live with different people who are not your parents, who are not related to you. You know what I mean?
I'm curious, though. Did you admire your mother's work ethic? Because she worked. She worked damn hard. She went wherever the work needed her. Or did you resent it that she was more loyal to her work than to you and your school?
I think we resented it. I mean, when I say me, it was me and my late sister. And I think we really did. When we were younger, you kind of think, well, this is how life is. And then you come across these families that you live with where the kids are stable. They
can make friends.
They can make friends.
Because they're there for more than 6 months.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know what I mean? They can make friends. And when they leave their home, their parents know where they are. Their parents know where to walk to go and tell them to come and eat. You know?
Yeah.
Where else you would have to stay close, you know, because you don't have friends in that area. You know, and if you do, they are school friends, you know.
So did you and your sister become very dependent on each other?
We became very dependent on one another, me and my sister. So what it automatically does is that as a kid, you become a pleaser. And I think that's where you become very dependable. You know, in that home, the least you can do is to make sure that when the kids who are supposed to be in that house are not there, the elders know who to depend on. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
You know, if they need to send somebody to the shop quickly, you make it a point that you are always around. So you please.
But it's kind of not what a kid should be doing.
I know. You know, in my mid-30s, I had a lot of anger, you know, and I eventually went to get a bit of help, you know. And I remember my psychic, as people would say, or my counselor, saying, it's all that stuff that you had to do that you didn't want to do, you know, being a pleaser. And particularly now, starting businesses, where you realize that people will always take advantage of you, if you know, because you're trying to please everyone, you know. And I remember this one guy saying to me, dude, the formula to success I don't have, but the formula to failure is trying to please everybody.
Yeah.
So you need to take off that jacket. You need to start understanding that there's no way that you can make a happy life for yourself by pleasing everyone, you know. So those are the disadvantages of, you know, being dependable.
As an adult, do you think you've been taken advantage of because you were trying to please people when you were a kid and you learned how to do that? I mean, did you ever have people asking you for money that you never got back? People expecting you to do things for them, even though they've done nothing for you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It still happens now.
Yeah.
You know, it's just now I'm wiser and I can sense it from the first, you know, breath of your phone call. I can already tell where this conversation is going to end. So, you know, and then I counter it before it even happens, you know, in the greeting. So Des, how are you? No, I'm alright, man. Hey, I'm just broke, my brother, man, you know.
You know what's coming.
Yeah. Yeah. So by the time I say I'm broke, it cuts the ultimate goal. By the time the guy goes, no, actually, I called you, man, to check if you could help me with something. I go, yeah, like I said in the beginning of this phone call, hey, I'm really broke, my brother. You know.
Because you have to protect yourself.
No, you've got to protect yourself.
But this is a very, like, it's a very black South African experience, too. Right. You know, we talk about the black tax and how everybody has to support, like, 4 or 5 people.
Absolutely,
in the family, and that's kind of how it works.
Or the whole family, yeah.
But you have to also look after yourself.
Sure.
Because otherwise, if you are the kind of person who's a pleaser, a helper, someone who always wants to be there for someone, you're dependable, all of those things, you will be taken advantage of. And ultimately, you'll end up in an old age home with nobody because you've been looking after everybody else in your life and they never return the favor.
Yeah. Also, I mean, if you're talking about black tax, is you're most likely to be laughed at when you're down and out by the same people who used to, you know what I mean? Who used to knock on your door.
And that is so cruel.
No, absolutely. The very same people who used to come, you know, I always tell the story of my choice to become an actor. You know, I went to college to study to be a teacher. But that was clearly my parents' dream.
Yeah.
And I remember when I made the choice to become an artist, to just say, look, can I go and perform? You know, the person who didn't know anything about the arts, and my grandmother, was the most supportive one. You know,
yeah.
Everybody else was like,
please don't.
So you want to go and play sketches, eh?
And how are you going to make money?
Yeah.
And how can we depend on you?
But those same voices became the voices that suddenly were, Mchana, is there any way that you can help with...
and you better believe when you weren't listening, they were telling everyone how they knew you.
Yeah. No, of course.
So tell me about this grandmother who was the only one who supported you when you made this decision.
My grandmother is she's a force of her own, man. She kind of just believed in, if you say I'm going to make this great, I won't disappoint you. That's all she wanted to know. You know, you're not going to be rude to people. You're not going to. Then she kind of goes, you seem like you love to do this thing. I don't know what it is. I don't know, but go and do it and do it well. You know, whereas everybody else who was slightly more enlightened and more educated, and I suppose that's what education comes with. People think they know, and they, you know, and
it gives you a false sense of security.
It gives you a false sense of security,
and you think you're in a position to tell other people what to do.
Yeah. So
it's that,
what?
It's that hubris.
So
that
Gareth,
arrogance.
You want to go and speak on the radio?
Yeah. What do you know about that?
Yeah. You want to go and speak on the radio? What is that?
Who do you think you are?
So you earn money to speak, to just speak?
Yeah.
No. But acting, go and look for a job.
I mean, when you tell, I think this is true everywhere in the world, because I'm sure there's never been a parent who, when they heard the words, I want to be an actor, went, oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I know.
Because they immediately think, oh, shit, we're going to be supporting this kid forever.
Yeah, no, that's true.
It is true. Yeah, and, for your parents, probably they just wanted you to be stable, and they probably just wanted you to be happy. And they thought, well, if you go into acting, we can't guarantee that.
Yeah. A friend of mine years ago obviously started having kids before me because he's older. His son was a perfect drawing artist. You know, this kid, like at 9, was, you know, could do this and look at you and go, shh, you know. And I remember him telling me, and he said, hey, Joe, I'm just seeing hunger. You know, my son just spends time because, you know, at the time, cell phones were not smartphones yet, you know. And he was just like, yo, you know, this kid is now an architect.
And I'm sure he's terrific.
One of the youngest architects in Rosebank. You know what I mean? And I'm just going, see?
You've got to follow that.
Yeah.
It's a courageous move. I mean, for you acting, when did it occur to you that this is what you wanted to do?
I tell this story. My mother had a bit of a fight with my grandmother. Because, you know, my mother was always out, you know, whether it was work or, you know, getting together with friends. And she wanted to go and watch a show. I don't know if you remember a group called Mahotela Queens.
Of course.
Mahlatini and Mahotela Queens, right?
Mahlasela.
Yeah. Mahlatini came to Kimberley, which is where, you know, we were at the time. And my mother really wanted to go and see this concert. Now, Mahlatini and Mahotela Queens those days, they used to put up a show, Gareth. They would come on stage in different regalia for like 4 or 5 songs, depending on if that the message of those 4 or 5 songs was sort of in the same category.
Mm-hmm.
And the set would be different. You know?
Like an old school type
of thing. You know, they would have Mbaola braziers in the background and that type of thing. And And then they would go, the lights would go out after the fourth song, you know, and then the band would keep on playing, and then they come back with different outfits, suddenly
big
afros and you know, and all that type of stuff. So my mother couldn't get somebody to stay with me because they had a fight with my grandmother. And I remember around 4 or 5 o'clock, I had just come back from school in my school uniform, and my mother just kept walking around with me to go and talk to that friend, because there were no cell phones at the time, to talk to that
someone
friend.
Someone look after Dad.
Yeah, can somebody stay with this boy? I have to go to this concert.
How old were you?
And I think I'm probably about 8 or 9.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I remember that very clearly. So it must have been at an age where I could remember things, you know. And she couldn't find anyone. And I think one of her friends said, why don't you bring him with? We have an extra ticket, you know. Just bring him with. And in my school uniform, little khaki, you know, I remember my mother, tuck in your shirt, you know. And I went with them to this concert. And I had never seen anything like that in my life as a kid, just sitting with thousands of people, watching a performance and people going crazy for these people on stage. And I remember going, this is so cool. This is what I want to do with my life.
Isn't it amazing to imagine that if your mother had found someone to look after you, you might not have seen that show.
Right.
You might not have been introduced to acting.
Right.
You might not, or performances. You might never have followed that dream. You might have become a teacher. Maybe you would have been a very good teacher. But
maybe.
This would never have known Desmond Dube.
Right. Right. It was, yeah.
Thank God none of those people were looking after anyone that day.
You know, but isn't that how the universe works?
That's amazing.
So I went to this concert, and that was it for me. That was the moment I decided. I was in the church youth group at the time, and not necessarily youth. I mean, I was still under the you know the younger youth group. And I remember one of the conferences, church conferences, and I decided to put an entire performance, which was really a copycat of the show that I had seen. And that's where the performance, I started doing things that I saw Mahatela Queens do live, you know. We put, you know, these girls on, and we were the band, and and then after that, because these church groups will always have some kind of competition. The guys coming from another region are competing against that region. And 2-3 years later, maybe even more, I realized that if I write a script, you know, if I start writing scripts and we actually mix our music with performance, those guys will never be able to do that. And then that's how it started, you know. And then that's it. That was me.
And what was the break from that into the real world of, like, professional acting?
Then the break came. Gibson Kente, who was known as the father of black theater at the time, would bring, once a year, he would bring a play to Kimberley. We would, you know, go and watch Gibson Kente's plays, which just drove me absolutely mad, because this man was a legend, you know. And some of the people we saw on stage, we would now see on TV as well. And I just kind of went, oh, my word, you know. So I went to audition for Gibson Kente. And people warned me. And people said, you know, you're going to go to Joburg. Gibson Kente doesn't really pay that well. You might end up, you know, on the streets. And then I still went, you know. And I did end up on the streets.
You didn't believe these people.
Just I didn't
like
believe
didn't,
these
you
people.
You didn't believe them when they
you
said,
know, yeah, go, I still went. And that was, you know, I ended up in the streets. But like you said earlier, you know, it's how the universe works. Because on the streets, that's where I started finding other people. That's, you know, there was an area called in Joburg, in the city center, called Mega Music, which is now called Baseline. The very same guys who are running Baseline.
Yeah.
They used to have a place called Mega Music, which was a rehearsal center. But more importantly, they used to rent out instruments to artists. So you'd find all these artists. The late Jabu Kanyile would be there. You know, Kaya Mahlangu would be there. the late Sipho Kumede. That's where I know these guys from. Yuma Sigela. We would play snooker with Brayu, and I was just some street kid, you know. But I basically just lived there because I would see these people. Mbongeni Ngema used to stand right here and buy food, you know, because they used that area to rehearse. And that's how I got my first break in the industry.
This is like the Entertainment University of South Africa.
Absolutely. You know, and that particular center, that's why we were so heartbroken when that center had to be taken away, because that's where Car Street is now, the Miri Makeba Road.
Yes.
That's where that center used to be, you know. So when the Johannesburg development happened, they had to remove that center. And that's why Des and them had to move to Baseline. Anyway, so just being around these people, and eventually a guy called, also late last year, John Lidwaba, fantastic playwright. He did shows like The Black Dog and Ekoli, you know, did those kind of plays. He was doing a play called Street Sisters at the time, a musical called Street Sisters. It was a play, it was a musical about prostitution on the streets of Johannesburg.
Yeah.
And Menzi Ngubane was in it. Hamilton Dlamini and, you know, Peter Mashiru, these guys.
Who's really the royalty of South Africa.
Yeah, these guys who had already been on TV as kids. And one actor just disappeared for about a week, you know. And lunchtime, these guys came out of the rehearsal sweating. You could see they had towels around their necks. And Menzi and Hamilton said, "This dude is always here." That was me. You know, "This dude is always here." And leaned over and said to Prajwan, "Can't we audition him and see if he can't just hold on to this role until we know what's happening with this other guy?" And John said, "Yeah, after lunch, come in." You know.
Wow.
And that was it. I auditioned.
And you aced it.
And then I was in that play. Needless to say, 2 years later, I was traveling the world because that play, you know, went on a tour for 22 months. You know, so from the streets to the streets of Europe, I started sending postcards, you know, to all my uncles, and my uncles were getting free booze.
Could they believe it?
Yeah. I think not at first. I think once the third postcard would come in with pictures that show that I'm really in Holland, you know, I'm in Holland, you know. They started getting cheap free booze in bars because they would go, Do you know who this is? Chikandi Lighty. Chikandi Lighty, can you see where this is? Look at the stamp, you know? And yeah. After tasting that, Gareth, you don't want to go back to the streets, trust me. You know. Once you've tasted the exposure of the world, you know, you realize that there is a bigger world out there than just a kid from Kimberley.
But that's it. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not really the fear of going back.
Yeah.
It's more that you've seen what there is, and you've seen what the world has to offer, and you're
right.
Like, I've got to get my backside
right
into whatever situation
right
is required
right
to keep this going and
right
to do more.
Sure.
So, I mean, you've never had a problem working hard, though. I mean, you'll do at any given time. You're busy with like three different things at once.
It's all I have. Being busy is all I have, you know. Somebody was asking me now. I mean, I was on a tour to England. I was doing The Suitcase with James Ngob, and we went on a tour for 4 months last year. And straight from that tour into King Kong, and someone was saying, "But you know, what about your kids?" And my kids said, "Well, that's all he does. He works."
Yeah, you don't feel guilty about that,
yeah,
because your mother, when you were younger,
yeah,
you kind of said you resented her. You're not worried about that. They've
yeah
got their mom around them all the
They've
time.
They've got their mom around them, but
they understand you.
Yeah.
They know. And when you're with them, you dedicate yourself
absolutely
to them.
That every hour means, this morning, for example, just before they go to school, was important that I'm the one waking them up, you know, so they can hear daddy's voice and that type of thing. But also we are conscious of it. So we're very aware of it. Thank God to technology as well. We
yeah
get to video call every day. So the kids can't, they don't have your presence there, but they talk to you
sure
on a daily basis. They know how you feel.
It's important to connect.
Yeah. If your day was a little bit hard, you share it with them and you say, "Oh, I had a bit of a tough day, but you know.
Would you be happy if your kids said that they wanted to be actors?
Whoa! You know, I think to counter that question is that, would I want my kids to be happy?
Yes.
The answer is yes. And happiness comes with what they choose to be happy in, or rather do for the rest of their lives, or for that time where they feel like, well, I want to be a pianist, you know, for the next couple of years until I'm tired of it, you know. So, yes, I want my kids to be happy. And if the choice was mine, I would say, no, no, don't do it.
Be just like those people who said you should.
Absolutely. If the choice was mine. But I realized that happiness is also just opening my heart and be happy for my child, whatever it is they choose to do. But it's probably the reason why I want to work as hard as I can, so that they don't have to worry about how I'm going to pay the rent if they become artists. Does that make sense?
No, I know what you mean. It's like you want to give them as much of a sense of responsibility as following their dreams.
Sure.
Do you feel, because you really have got this ability to connect with all kinds of people in South Africa, you speak the 9 languages, there isn't a community that feels you're outside of them.
Mm.
And that's a privileged place to be, but it does lead to the fact that some people in certain sectors will say, oh, he's ours.
Yeah.
And then you feel, well, I don't know if you feel this, maybe you could tell me otherwise, but it leads to a situation where sometimes one group will say, he doesn't belong here.
Yeah.
You know, if you speak Sizulu and you're around Afrikaans people, they suddenly think, oh, he's not of us.
Yeah.
And if you're speaking Afrikaans around Zulu people, they maybe feel you're not one of us.
Mm.
And sometimes you get called things, I'm sure. You've maybe heard, because it's happened to me sometimes, where people say, oh, we're not going to keep him in our community.
Yeah.
Does that ever become a problem for you, or how do you deal with it when it gets brought up?
I think I've been fortunate enough that it hasn't happened blatantly, like where I get to know about it. A year about it. Maybe some people feel like, well, it doesn't belong.
Yeah, no, but you hear a whisper.
Yeah, but you know. But
I don't think a lot of people are courageous enough to come up to you.
Absolutely.
You
know. Except if you are on Black Twitter, of course.
Or drunk.
Yeah, you know. So, but I think what has kept me going is the fact that as much as I didn't like it as a kid, having to go to different schools in different provinces, and you need to remember that the history of South Africa is, if you were going to school in the Eastern Cape, the mother tongue of that province would be Xhosa.
Yeah.
Period.
Right.
You know, they don't want to know. They don't want to know that you grew up speaking Sotho in your home. They don't want to know that. You'll have to learn how to speak. So the advantage of that is that even now, being brand ambassador for Clientele and IFA and so on, when I go to these regions, I'm able to speak the language. So people don't feel like he doesn't belong here.
And maybe not maybe not belonging is a kind of superpower.
Yeah.
In that you don't actually feel like my identity is tied to this thing.
Right.
So I can't extend myself here and here and here.
Right.
To be able to speak with those people and with those people and be able to connect with all these people.
Right.
Without having to feel I'm giving anything away.
Right. Right.
Because a lot of people are so tied up in that identity, whether it's a language thing, whether it's a tribal thing, whether it's a racial thing.
Mm.
They're so tied into that that it makes them unable to really take the leap and hold hands.
But you see, that's what exposure does. And that those very same lessons that I got from moving around with my mother taught me to learn how each and every one of these cultures operate. Do you see how handy it becomes later?
That's a superpower.
Like everything else. So you know that when you go to a certain region, for example, the Tswana region, and you hear the ignorance of people talking about Xhosas, for example, or maybe Swati people, or whatever it is. And you kind of go, no, but that's not why they do that. And I think that's where even issues of racism.
Yeah.
I always say racism is just pure ignorance. Is not knowing the other culture, you know. And we've seen it in a broader sense, in a worldly sense, where I remember a friend of mine, we were in traveling through Dubai, and they were giving us all these things that you can't do in Dubai. You can't wear short skirts. You can't, you know, you can't hold hands, and if you happen to marry or become involved with an Emirati girl, the Emiratis immediately disown her,
Yes.
And then I went and asked the questions, to the guy who was driving us. And I remember this guy just explaining things, and I went, wow.
It's not what you thought.
It's not what I thought. It's not trying to oppress women. It's got nothing to do with that. It's a cultural thing that they want to hang on to, and they know that if they don't put those rules in place, that culture will be gone. The Emirati people will be gone,
Yeah, but don't you also think that when you hear stuff like that, like some cultural stuff should go? Some cultural stuff's just not really valid anymore. I mean, it's never, in my opinion, it just shouldn't ever be right that, you should stone your daughter to death for adultery, or that your wife shouldn't be able to drive a car, or things like that. That's just crazy. Those things have got to change.
Look,
cultural, traditional, that's all good and well. But, I mean, I respect the fact that there are things about, white Western civilization that maybe my ancestors thought were important that I don't think are important anymore.
Mm.
Things change.
No, true. Things do change. There's always, like, you need to understand it. I think that's the point I'm trying to make.
Mm.
You need to understand why there was a rule.
I totally agree with you that, ignorance is the fountain of all the problems.
Right.
And it's when you are willfully ignorant that you are possibly a bad person, because you've chosen not to understand.
And yours is right. And I think for me, that's the worst. And I think that's where racism from all sectors come from, is that you don't want to take time to learn why the other person does what they do, black people speak loud. We lived in villages, right? The other house was 500 meters away. We didn't have phones. So I have to, remember that ad?
Yeah.
So we become loud because we come from, and it's understandable. So you kind of go, that's why these guys are so loud. You know how often my wife is one of the quietest people. But when my sisters are around and they talk to each other, I always lean over and go, you do know that she's sitting right here. I'm in the bedroom. I can hear you guys. And then they go, sorry. But for 20 minutes later, it's
because they're excited to see each other. They're enjoying the conversation. Dude, I could talk to you all day.
Right.
I mean, we've got to actually, what I want to do is get you in one day and not just talk about your life, which is fascinating, because I think, there's stories that you haven't even been able to get to here that I wanted to talk to you about. Hotel Rwanda, all that stuff.
Right.
We will.
Yeah.
But I also, one day I just want to have you in and talk about current affairs, because I think you'd be the kind of guy we should get in one day and ask about, what do you think of this that's in the news?
Sure.
I would be fascinated to hear your opinion. You seem to be a very observant guy. You'd have to be an actor.
You're watching
people all the time.
No, absolutely. Right? You have to study people. So, that's what it is. You study people, and that's why you can see bullish coming. New leader comes up, look at him and you go, I'm not sure about your guy. I see you guys excited, but your guy, I can see. This guy's got, you see the plot. It's like watching movies. My kids get irritated. The first 20 minutes of the film, I know where it's going.
Yeah. Do you ever sit through a movie if it's shit? You get up and leave?
Yes. I get up and leave. I'm that guy.
Yeah.
I get up
I've
and leave.
I've done that. But people think it's rude, apparently.
But it depends. Yeah. But it also depends what I'm in the mood for. Sometimes I'm in the mood to watch a crap movie. and as in you, because your lessons are what not to do.
Yeah. Well, as an actor, then you watch it almost like a science experiment.
Sure.
Yeah, and you know it's going to go wrong, but you want to see.
You want to see. You know, you want to see how bad it's going to go. You know.
Well, I can tell you, from everything I've seen that you've been involved in, you seem to add gold.
No, thank you.
To it,
thank
and you. And you've been around because you're good, and you'll be around for a long time because you're good.
Right.
And I think South Africans love you.
Right.
I think that your career is testament to someone who really is a hard worker and a talent.
Right.
And I hope that we'll have many, many more years of Desmond Dube.
No, we should. We should. I mean, there's obviously sort of sectors of the industry that I want to break into. You know, I still haven't done my own film.
Yeah, you got to do that.
And people have been saying, listen,
you but know, you need when, to have money. Coming? You need to have a lot of money.
You
to
need
make
to have
a
lot of money, but you also need to have
those budgets
the
crazy.
Right idea. You know what I mean?
Have like, you not been working on scripts and things?
I've been looking at scripts at the moment. There is actually a script now that I kind of go, ooh, okay, this thing here seems very special. Right. You know, it talks to, like you said earlier, it talks to, it's a crossboard, you know. I can see someone from the township and someone from Bryanston going to the same movie house to go and watch this
film.
That
sounds good.
You know what I mean?
That sounds good.
And yet it still has the dignity that we need in our films, you know. So there is a couple of scripts that are beginning to sort of surface, you know.
We look forward to it. And I've got to say, it's a real pleasure to sit down and actually talk to you face to face for the
first
time.
It's a pleasure to be at Cliff Central. Everything
thank
is
you.
Cliff here.
Yeah, I know.
Central, yeah.
Desmond Cliff Dube, Anna. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much.
What a pleasure.
Hey, ta-da.
This is CliffCentral.com.